is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason, and you're listening to the hashtag SDRAsk podcast.
Hey, Amy.
Greg. Let's start with a question from Jared Bolus. Recently on the Babylon Bee podcast, you addressed questions that were presented in, quote, gauntlet fashion. How do you tactically maneuver the gauntlet strategy when someone uses it in discussion with you, especially if the objector is somewhat hostile?
Well, this is very similar to a steamroller circumstance. Now, what we did on Babylon Bee wasn't steamroller. It was just like, let's get the fast answers out. And I guess I could say, because of my just experience in dealing with these things, some of the things that were asked me, I could think about them because I'd worked through them before, and I could reduce them in a sense to their most basic point and give something substantive. I don't know that most people are capable of doing that, though it'd be good to practice. And one of the reasons that I can do that is because I've either and or in this case been doing it a long time, and or I practice beforehand. That is, I think, and frankly, I can't not do this anymore. When things come up and I hear about it, I start thinking, okay, what would I say to that that would get right to the heart of the matter? What question could I use? What substantive response might I offer in a quick thought? Okay, that's just a matter of practice, and that's all I could say is that it just is going to take that kind of thing for people to be able to do that in that way. Now, oftentimes, though, this, as was mentioned in the question, is a result of a hostile questioner who is pushing hard and ready to interrupt. And this is where it just seems that it's appropriate, and it's part of the steamroller tactic in the book, to request more time. It's the first step. The first step of stopping a steamroller or dealing with a steamroller. I just call it stop it. Stop them. It's stop them, shame them, leave them are the three steps. And stop them just means ask for more time in a gracious way. Hold on, Amy. I'm not quite done yet. Can I finish the thought kind of thing? Little body the English that's going on there, and I'll let you back in a moment. Okay, I just need to finish the thought. Is that okay? So you're asking permission for the person to allow you to finish, and it's also requesting a polite interaction. And much of the time, I say most of the time, that's all that's required. So in this particular case, that might be what's necessary. So first, it's good if we can work on some of our ideas so that we are able to express them in a more terse manner. And secondly, if we can't, we buy some time by asking for time from the person who appears to be overly aggressive. And sometimes it's a group of people, and that's when you have to say, wait a minute, one person at a time. Okay, I don't mind interacting, but this can't be, I'm trying to think of a way of saying it, like it can't be a gang hit and run kind of deal, you know. So it's just one at a time. So who this first question, let me deal with that before anybody else jumps in, and then we'll take the next one, kind of thing. Okay. Now, I have just written a series of articles for Stand to Reason. They're on our website. All of this year, pretty much, I've focused on the same thing, and these are a version of tactics that I have been calling street tactics, but it looks like I'm going to make a book proposal to Zondervan and probably title the book Street Smarts, and the subtitle have the word tactics in it. So it's part of the tactics franchise, but the whole goal of that is to give people a leg up, a springboard, when a particular challenge is asked of them. Here's a strategy to go about answering it, and here are the questions that you can start the conversation with. So all of that might help. Keep an eye out for that. I mean, it might be another year before we're back in play on that one. Probably Christmas next year, it'll be a premium, God willing.
I just wanted to say one thing that when someone's throwing a lot of questions at you, there is such a temptation to jump off on a bunch of different areas.
Tangents.
Yes. There's such a temptation, especially if you have something you want to say to what they're asking you. So it's a discipline to to decide you're going to follow one thing to the end before you get to the next thing. And that is, it's really hard to do, just to keep on track with one answer until you are done with that answer. Mm-hmm. But just keep bringing it back and don't give in to that temptation to start answering little bits of a bunch of different questions. You want to follow one to the end as much as you can.
Right.
That's been my experience anyway.
And by the way, one of the most frequent interruptive elements is, well, that's in the Bible and I don't believe in the Bible. Oh, you're telling me that's all in the Bible. I don't believe in the Bible. And that's when it's appropriate to say, wait a minute, that's a separate issue. What you asked me is how I would answer this question. And so I am going to give you the answer from the biblical worldview. Now, if you want to believe in it or not, that's up to you. That's a separate issue. Okay. But I need to be clear on exactly what the view is. And by the way, sometimes the view that we give from the Bible gives credibility to the at least the wisdom and insight of the Bible, because the response turns out to be a good one. And what I mean by that is it resonates with our deepest intuitions about the way the world actually is. So I gave a talk yesterday at a Christian high school about the problem of evil. And I always start that out by saying that the theist isn't the only one who has to deal with the problem of evil. This is a problem for everybody. Everybody knows there's a problem of evil, which is why it comes up so often against Christianity. But the atheist, if he disregards God because of evil, he hasn't solved the problem. He still has to answer it. Now, how is he going to answer the problem of evil without the resources of a God who grounds morality? Now it's just meat all the way down. Now there is no right or wrong out there in the world. Maybe he can appeal to evolution or something, but that's inside morality, the morality that evolution creates inside. But the objection about the problem of evil is evil out there in the world, not just some things that disagree with my opinion. And so this is – if we are given time to say here is the biblical view, or the way evil came into the world is human beings broke God's standards and therefore were guilty. And by the way, most of us feel guilty for a reason. What this does, it allows us to give our accounting, even if the person says, I don't believe in the Bible. My response is that's not relevant at this point. What's relevant is you're asking me how my worldview answers this question. So I just want to finish answering the question. And then you're free to say that comes from the Bible. I don't believe it. That's up to you. But my conviction is, and I've said this many times, the Christian worldview reflected in the Bible is the best explanation for the way things are. And so when we explain how there's such a fit between the biblical view and the way the world actually is, oh, that makes sense of this thing. That actually commends the biblical account to the listener, even if they're not willing to listen at that moment. It has explanatory power.
Okay, here is a question from Robert. He asked a question about Halloween, and unfortunately, we are a little bit ahead, so I didn't get this question until after Halloween, but we're not that far away from it. So here's his question. What are your thoughts on getting intentionally scared? Is fear for entertainment an emotion we shouldn't, as Christians, be seeking?
You know, I've never had that question quite like that before. Lots of questions about different aspects of Halloween. But what about intentionally getting scared? I don't know. I know there's a misunderstanding of a passage in 2 Timothy. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of sound love and discipline, sound mind, that kind of thing. But what he's talking about there is God has not given us a spirit, and he doesn't mean a demonic spirit. And that's the way some people read it. There is a spirit of fear floating around here. We have to rebuke it. He means an attitude of reluctance based on fear of people. Timothy was timid. Timothy, don't be timid anymore. I am not ashamed of the gospel. You shouldn't be ashamed of the gospel either, even in spite of the opposition. So I do not think that the Bible is speaking against the feeling of fear. All right. Now, I happen to know, like, my mom used to love these things. And she would drag me off to these movies when I was a kid, like The Haunting of Hill House and of Hill House, rather, and The Pit and the Pendulum, these kind of what would be considered now cheesy horror movies, like B movies, but they were popular in the 50s and really frightened me badly. Now, I don't think that was good for me. To be frightened, because I was a child, and those kinds of characterizations can really go deep to primal fear type things, and it shook me up. However, as an adult, I don't think there was anything wrong with my mom getting some kind of stimulation with fright stuff. I think it depends on the individual. I don't think it's a sinful thing. Now, you may have different opinions, but fear is just an emotion that God has given us for good purpose, and some people like to be shaken by it. Lots of movies that are action movies are, I think, now that I think about it, trade on the idea that there is serious conflict here that will not get resolved. In fact, every story has conflict. Lord of the Rings is filled with conflict. So then there's an element of uncertainty and angst about how it will play out. How will they get themselves out of this? So that's what adds interest to the story. And I think it also it has a relationship, now that I'm thinking about it, to our sense of justice, because in many of these circumstances, there are unjust things going around. Lord of the Rings is a perfect example. There's Sauron, you know, and with the big eye looking down, wants to control the world with his evil intent. And will they win? And so there's an angst, an anxiety, a type of fear that's built in there that is really part of the story. And then that fear is relieved at the climax, and there's a relief, and then there's a sense of euphoria that comes from that. So I guess I've never been asked this question before. I'm just now thinking out loud, but the more I think about it, I think that in general, I don't think it's wrong. I don't see any biblical thing against it. And sometimes it's appropriate to fear things that are dangerous. In fact, I say that in the book, in the story of reality, that some of this, what I read here in the chapter on perfect justice, is going to frighten some of you, but that's okay, because it's good to be scared of things that are dangerous, and God is dangerous. So I don't have a problem there, unless a child is unwittingly being dragged along. And it's emotionally difficult for them. I know that my 12-year-old Eva is particularly sensitive to these kinds of things, and she doesn't like watching them, where my 15-year-old seems to have no problem with it. I wish she had more problem with it than she does sometimes. So I think it's relatively neutral, and it depends on the circumstances, would be my short answer.
I think there are a lot of different kinds of scares that people seek out. So, for example, like the scares you refer to in Lord of the Rings, you know, seeing the horror of evil and feeling the fear of that, and then seeing triumph over that, well, that's just looking at what reality is like. There is evil in the world, and we Right. want to see the triumph. So if that's the kind of scare, that's one kind. Now, if I just look at let's just look at horror movies in terms of this question. Maybe he's probably thinking about that on Halloween. Well, horror movies, there are a lot of different kinds of scares there too. Mm-hmm. And some are darker than others. And right. Some are about spiritual evil. And that's a different kind of scare than maybe a monster or an evil serial killer or whatever that is. But I think whether or not it's something we should seek out depends on the movie. What is the perspective of the movie? Is it glorifying the evil? Is it glorifying the supernatural demons? Or is someone conquering those things? Mm-hmm. Does good win in the end? The perspective of the film, I think, makes a difference as to how it will affect us mentally and spiritually. Is evil ultimate in the film? Mm-hmm. Is there nothing greater than the evil? Does the evil win? Or, like I said, is there a morality? A lot of horror movies have a really strong sense of justice, where if someone does something bad, they really get it in the end. That's kind of part of the genre. So there is a kind of morality in there. That the idea that the supernatural is real, that is scary, but it's scary because it's actually real, and that's why it scares us. So all these things, I agree with you, Greg. It probably depends on the person whether or not one should watch these things. I think the last one I saw, I can't remember if it was the Blair Witch Project, but I was like,
I did write that down because we saw that many years ago, and it's actually portrayed as a documentary. I mean, that's the motif of the film. No one's confused that it's a documentary. It's just the way the film is done. But that was really scary, and especially the last scene. And a lot of people who weren't paying attention to the narrative didn't get the significance of the last scene, that one child standing in the corner. But it was mortifying. And that's one I wish I'm never seeing that again. So this is a good point, because sometimes there is such a characterization and a depiction of evil that it sours the conscience in some way. It sours the soul in some way. I'm thinking of No Place for Old Men, I think it won an Academy Award. Is that the title of it? No Place for Old Men or something like that?
I think so.
It was a bad guy who was really bad, but he never got his comeuppance. And so even Fargo. My wife and I started watching Fargo, and we walked out because we thought it was kind of a glorification of evil. Now, it turned out the bad guy did get the comeuppance in the end, and we didn't see that satisfaction. But sometimes when my wife and I are watching a movie that has a lot of intensity and bad guys in it, she doesn't want to stop because she says, I want to go to the end and see the resolution so I can feel the ends tied off and I can go to bed and sleep knowing the bad guy got his, you know, comeuppance kind of thing. So some of these films, like No Place for Old Men, are utterly nihilistic, and they're evil and dark. And so there are things that you're just going to walk out of. And we have walked out of a number of films that were like that. I never saw Old Place for No Man just because I knew what it was about. And I did not want to countenance this gruesome stuff. And so for me, there's two kinds of violence. There is what I call crash boom violence, you know, and this is like you see with all the superhero movies, you know, and it's unrealistic violence. I mean, people are getting thrown all over the place. Nobody really gets hurt very badly. All right. But then you have violence that's egregious, and it's the kind of thing you can imagine really happening. And I think that Hannibal Lecter movie, the first one,
Greg,
that was a similar kind of movie. Magnificently done and performed, but it was just one of those things that gets completely under your skin. And these, I don't think, are good for the soul. So I think it does depend on the way things are depicted and the impact they have on people. There was a movie called 13 Millimeters too. This is about a film that somebody found, and they started playing the film, and there were such gruesome things on this film that it was hard to countenance, and there were real things that had happened to real people, according to the film, you know, and the narrative of the film. And this is stuff where we just say no. But I don't know. I guess that's a kind of scariness, but that's not a spook boo scariness. There are people out there that do this kind of thing. OMG kind of deal, you know, and the fact is there are people out there that do this kind of thing, and that isn't what we need to focus in on. So I think that qualifier is a really, really important one here. It depends. Being spooked depends on the kind of spooked you are. And some people can see through a lot of these goofy, spooky, The Pit and the Pendulum, you know, Vincent Price or Boris Karloff of an era before that, you know, and the Frankenstein guys walking stiffly. When I was a kid, that scared me a lot. Now I watch it, it's no big deal. And actually, we just saw the Frankenstein with one of the Mel Brooks takeoffs on that. It was quite funny. But when I was a kid, that would really freak me. And so I think that's the factor that matters.
Yeah, I was really traumatized by The Silence of the Lambs and by Blair Witch Project. And after the Blair Witch Project.
And you were grown up.
Yeah, for both of them. Yeah. And ever since then, I've just been really careful because I'm like, why do I want to feel like this?
Sure.
I don't want to. Right. I don't want to do this on purpose. But but most movies have some form of scaring you or intensity or some kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Suspense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think a little of that is pretty much part of every single story because that's the story we're living in. This world.
That's what makes a story too. Conflict.
Right. We are in suspense now. We are seeing evil now in this world. But we know at the end of the world, God will step in and make everything right. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to see. It's not so much the evil as much as we want to see the evil made right at the end of whatever story
sure.
we're watching.
Or something like The Shining. You know, this is like over the top. You know, Stephen King. I remember seeing the Stephen King movie Misery and Academy Award performance in there too. But it was James Caan was the writer, remember, that had an accident and was holed up in this thing. And he was taken care of by a nurse there in her home. And she was his greatest fan kind of deal. And then things went south from there. He was immobilized because of his injuries. And anyway, there were times in that movie that I felt I wanted to crawl under the seat of the theater. And it was just too much. There was a comeuppance at the end. It kind of came around, but it was really hard to go through some of that. Sometimes you don't know they're coming. I didn't know that was coming. But others are, you know. I mean, if it's Stephen King, something's coming, all right? With the only exception I can think of is Stand By Me, and which is a marvelous movie, which he wrote, actually. Which has got a lot of pathos in it, and it's got a dead body in it, you know, as it turns out, but it's not. It's about young kids coming of age, and it's actually very touching.
Didn't he write The Shawshank Redemption also?
He wrote the what?
Didn't he write The Shawshank Redemption?
Oh, I don't. I'm not sure about
that, actually.
I don't know. But most of his writings have become movies. Carrie was his first one that they made a movie out of, and that really shot him in the national prominence.
Well,
that was
Robert,
pretty gory.
Hopefully that gives you some things to chew on and think about. I know there are actually a lot of Christians who are into horror movies because of the supernatural element, you know, being taken seriously, and which is one of the only genres that you see that in these days. But
yeah, but you got this whole zombie thing going on and the Dracula stuff. But that's I don't watch that stuff. But it strikes me that this is a bit on the cartoonish side. You know, this is kind of like silly side. These people, you know, you can't kill. It's just crazy. You know, the Night of the Living Dead, which was an old example of this, but now it's taken on a new form and so many more. But those all strike me as kind of silly. They're not taken seriously. I haven't seen them to know, but in any event, I think that's enough. We've covered the horror genre probably adequately. People are feverishly writing down names of movies now. I got to go get Misty and or is it Misty or Misery or
Misery? Misery. Is the one. Yeah.
And anyway, I'm not going to even repeat the titles. What was that again?
Oh gosh, I just remembered another one that really scared me recently, but I won't even say it.
Well, I'm curious now.
It was called Buried. And
B-U-R-I-D?
Yes.
Why would anybody go to a movie with that title? You don't have to know.
I watched it at home, and I had to keep stopping the movie and getting up and walking around and breathing because I couldn't breathe. The entire movie takes place. A guy is buried in a box.
Good enough. Enough said. Man.
Yeah.
My wife, when she falls asleep, she jerks, and I could tell that's when she's falling asleep. You know, people do that. They have that little jerk. I call it the Blair Twitch. So we're just ending on a humorous note here.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for your questions. So send us those questions, and the way you do that is you go onto Twitter, you type out a tweet with your question, and all you need to do is put your put hashtag STRask somewhere in the question, and I will see that, and we will consider that for our show. And that's how we do the show. So we depend on your questions.
And you never know what kind of mileage we're going to get out of your question, like this last one.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.